Just a little bit of personal time. I want to share with you one of my heroes, and you've heard me say this before, is this gentleman sitting right here, Alan Gottlieb. This coming March will mark 20 years of me being on the air with Tom Gresham's Gun Talk Radio, and it's because of him. I blame him completely for the whole thing. Because I went to him at a SHOT Show 20 years ago, and we were talking. He says, have you ever done radio before? I said, no. He says, you ought to think about doing radio. See what you started? My heavens. But it's been a real crazy fun ride, and we've spun that off to 3 TV shows and a lot of videos and a lot of other things we do. It's all under the Gun Talk brand, and appreciate all of you watching, listening, and straightening me out whenever I get things wrong, which is all too often. Gun Rights Policy Conference. Great turnout. I mean, you know, who cares if the airlines don't fly? We can still get here. They haven't stopped us any other way. This isn't going to stop us either. Imagine 29 years. It makes us about in the mid-80s. First Gun Rights Policy Conference. Miley Cyrus wasn't born. An IBM PC was running on an Intel 8088 chip. And if you were lucky, you had a 10 megabyte hard drive. But we all thought, who would ever be able to use 10 megabytes anyway, really? Now, if you were on the leading edge of technology, you had just upgraded to a 1200 baud modem, which was almost too fast for you to be able to actually read the text as it's downloading. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. Microsoft had just introduced this crazy program called Windows. They still don't have it right. Miller Lite Beer was running a series of commercials. Some of you are old enough to remember. Had a tagline, it tastes great, less filling. One of the guys on those commercials was this crazy-looking guy with sideburns and a cowboy hat. It was my dad, Gritch Gresham. Now, I bring him up because what a lot of people don't know, didn't know then, was they had a rabid, not just a gun guy, but a gun rights guy on the Miller Lite commercials. And I have this memory as I'm sitting there looking at everybody, and I'm listening to the speeches today. They're all wonderful. I have this memory of my dad taking me to Washington, D.C. in the late 70s, and I just have this image of him with Senator Russell Long from Louisiana, and he has backed Russell Long, U.S. Senator, against a wall in the hall, and he's punching him in the chest like this, and he's explaining to him that he's not going to pass that damn gun control law. And that's when I learned a lot of things. That's when I understood what we can and what we must do. We must be involved. And the fact that you're here means you already are. We must not fear those powerful people in political positions. I don't think anybody here fears politicians. Maybe some of them fear us. We must never give up. We must never give up. And we won't. We're never going to give up. So I got a news flash for the gun banners. And they're not gun control people. They're gun banners. Make no mistake. No matter what they're calling for this time, where they want to go is to ban guns. Ultimately, that's where you go. I had a spokesman from the Violence Policy Center on my radio show one time. And he was ducking and dodging and bobbing and weaving, and I pressed him. And finally I said, well, look, if you got to be king, if you got to wave a magic wand, you could get anything you wanted, what would you want for guns? He said, well, I'd get rid of all the guns. I said, okay. I said, well, and then I just had this thought. I said, well, what about the police? He said, well, once we get rid of all the guns, they're not going to need any either. Yeah, that'll work. That's going to work. I don't care where they are all gun banners. There you go. So my news flash for the gun banners is, We're not going away. All right? We're never going to give up. We are winning. We know how to win. We're getting better at it. We're getting bigger. And we will keep fighting, and we will keep working and getting our gun rights back. That's my warning to them. All right, we got a fabulous lineup of folks here. I want to just introduce the head table. We got Seth Wall over here, NSSF. Got Belinda Rowe on the end over here. Obviously, Ron Ezell, Joe Tartareau. Of course, you know Alan Gottlieb. Over here, we got David Siegel. Some guy sitting next to him. And we have Michael Moore here. Now, what a lot of people don't know about our superstar attorney, who Heller McDonald, Mr. Alan Gura, is also prosecuting taking a case, defending a man. It's an important case, who was involved in a parking lot because he had a for sale sign on his car. So when I'm not making this up, he takes the big cases and he takes the smaller cases. It's a First Amendment case. But I'll tell you what, you talk about a guy who has won the big ones. We just won huge cases, one this week. I mean, and he's going to tell you more about that. I really don't need to explain any more who Alan Gura is, other than to get out of the way and let him come up here and speak. Alan Gura.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me. Is this thing, is that better? All right. Wrong way, that's right. Here we go. I'll let the radio guy play with the microphone. All right. Can you all see me? All right. Yeah, I'm sorry. I prepared some fantastic remarks for all of you. Unfortunately, I partied a little bit last night too much with some air traffic controllers, and we burned the speech. So it's canceled. Bye. I'm sorry. Let me be clear. If you want to keep listening, you can keep listening. All right. It's always great to be in Chicago, home of so many Second Amendment victories. McDonald versus Chicago, Ezell v. Chicago, Moore versus Madigan, Illinois Firearms. Illinois Firearms retailers, so far, there will be many more, I am certain, and it's an honor to share with you some insight into where we are today and where we may be going tomorrow. Now, those of you who have heard me speak before know that any such discussion always begins with the following disclaimer. From the moment the Supreme Court decided Heller, and ever since, I've always cautioned that nobody in America is fully satisfied with the state of First Amendment law or Fourth Amendment law or most other individual rights doctrines, and that will also become true of the Second Amendment. Sometimes the courts will get it right, and sometimes the courts will get it wrong. Whatever your perfect vision of the right to bear arms may be, it probably will not be realized. However, if we litigate carefully in a responsible, intelligent manner, at the end of the day, our side will come out ahead. Of that I am certain. We are definitely ahead of where we were this time last year, and we are way ahead of where we were last time this conference was held in this room back in 2011. But there have also been some disappointments in the various deep conflicts among the lower courts, and their approaches to Second Amendment questions leave many people wondering where the Supreme Court is in all of this. Since we won McDonald versus City of Chicago in 2010, extending the Second Amendment's requirements to state and local government, the Supreme Court has taken no cases concerning the right to keep and bear arms, not for lack of opportunity. A broad array of challenges arising in various circumstances and litigated differently by different fairly capable people have all been rebuffed. Let's review some of them briefly. In DeLacy versus California, the Supreme Court turned down the cert petition filed by Chuck Michel, challenging California's 10-year gun prohibition against people convicted of misdemeanor assault. In Williams versus Maryland, the Supreme Court turned down Steve Halbrook's cert petition that sought to challenge Maryland's discretionary permit system for handgun carrying. Now, this one is interesting because the Maryland Court of Appeals refused to consider whether the right to bear arms extended outside the home and all but dared the Supreme Court to say that it does. Similarly, the Supreme Court turned down the cert petition in Machandaro versus U.S., challenging the since-repealed ban on having guns in national parklands. The gentleman in that case was convicted because he pulled his car over to sleep for the night on Dangerfield Island in Alexandria, Virginia, close to home for me, very literally. NRA-CRDF-backed Chardon versus Massachusetts, a cert petition that asked whether youth infractions can support the state's decision that a now responsible adult is unsuitable to bear arms. Denied. Sticking with the youth theme, the Supreme Court turned down a great cert petition filed by Paul Clement and NRA versus VATF, challenging the federal prohibition on handgun sales by licensed dealers to adults aged 18 to 20, notwithstanding an 8-7 split on the Fifth Circuit and a wonderful amicus brief filed by yours truly on behalf of SAF, the case was turned down. Also turned down was Chuck Cooper's companion case there for NRA versus McGraw, challenging the state's Texas's ban on handgun carrying by the same aged 18 to 20 cohort. My recent petitions for SAF have also been turned down, most notably in Kochalski versus County of Westchester, Woolard versus Gallagher, and Drake versus Jerejian, challenging the virtual carry bans in New York, Maryland, and New Jersey, respectively. The last one, Drake, is notable for several reasons. Unlike most other anti-carry decisions, which either assume that there is a right to bear arms, but believe that may issue is an appropriate regulation of that right, or which declined to reach the issue at all, the Drake majority had an interesting approach. The court correctly decided that New Jersey's law is inconsistent with the right to bear arms, but then it held, incredibly, that enactment of the law is evidence that the right doesn't exist. Think about that. Under this logic, nothing is ever unconstitutional, not just in the gun area, but anywhere. Now, we drew a very strong dissent in Drake from Judge Hardiman. In our petition for rehearing by the full court, we drew 4 votes, which would have been more than enough had we drawn a different panel in the Third Circuit, but the other side had 8. Another note for those who think elections don't matter, I think this is interesting. The author of that opinion was appointed to the bench by President Lyndon Johnson, that's the second President Johnson, in 1968. I'm not guaranteeing that we would have won with a Barry Goldwater judge, but those two candidates back in 1964 had different visions of the Constitution. Their nominees might have had different perspectives on this topic as well. Now, the 4 votes that we got in the Third Circuit would have also been enough to get cert at the Supreme Court had we only obtained them at the Supreme Court. Absent the very rare written dissent from denial of cert, one rarely knows the actual vote breakdown when the justices consider which cases to take. But Drake, we do know, was relisted twice. That means the justices considered whether to take this case not once, not twice, but at 3 of their conferences. Obviously, someone up there believed it warranted serious consideration. In the end, however, the issue was left for another day. Now, the question arises, would we have done better had the state of Illinois petitioned the Supreme Court to review our victory in Moore versus Madigan? Maybe. If Drake is a 3-conference petition, Moore would have almost assuredly been granted, if only because the court is always more interested in cases where the government had lost and a law was struck down. Courts like to presume that democratically elected laws, formulated laws, are constitutional. Even though in the civil rights field there's no presumption of constitutionality, the fact is the Supreme Court is more likely to get involved if a lower court has struck something down rather than let things stand the way they've been standing for many decades. Now, substantively, would a pure total carry ban case be better for us than a somewhat hazier discretionary regulation case? I have my doubts. We've seen decisions that aren't shy about saying, you have a fundamental right to carry handguns for self-defense, but it's totally constitutional for the police to stop you from doing so without a reason that they believe to be good enough. Please do not underestimate the level of resistance in some quarters to this right. A strong right to bear arms opinion in a so-called pure case could send some unmistakable messages to recalcitrant lower courts. We would welcome that. But Heller has already done that, and it's not always clearly received. In any event, there are some additional Second Amendment cases wending their way to the Supreme Court, and some of those do deal with bare arms, and we'll see what develops in the coming months and years. When? And if not soon, why not? The question arises all the time. Here's what one journalist wrote me recently in an email. I'll read this to you. Here's the question. If it takes four to cert, and there are at least four who presumably want to push Heller further, why hasn't a case been certed since Heller? Close quote. Well, because I'm lazy and don't want to reinvent this wheel, I'll just share with you my response that I wrote back. Why do you say that there are at least four who presumably want to push Heller further? Without interviewing the justices, that's entirely speculative. Logically, one would imagine that there would be additional Second Amendment cases. It's an actively litigated constitutional provision, and the lower courts are all over the place. But that doesn't mean that the court has an agenda. It's the court's job to decide important constitutional cases. And why do you use a loaded term like push further? How about enforce compliance with what's already been announced? Is it possible that some courts are just getting Heller wrong or not following it? Push further is also loaded in the sense that it implies Heller was itself a push. I would reject that. From my perspective, Heller is perfectly fine. It doesn't need to be pushed further. It does need to be applied. The other side seems to think that Heller is limited to its facts, so any new application is pushing further. Is that how our system usually works? I don't know that there are four or five or two justices who want to do anything in particular. Everyone wants to think that their favorite issue is deeply important to the justices who spend lots of time closely following all the developments in lower courts and dreaming of the ideal case in which to advance their special vision, but the reality is probably more mundane than that. The court is busy, it can only take so many cases, and can expend only so much energy per term. Decisions in a particular petition aren't made in a vacuum. It probably matters, for example, what else they've already taken or not taken in a given year. Supreme Court practitioners definitely think as much with all the thought that is spent on timing petitions for particular conferences. Now, obviously, a case must be substantively compelling to be granted, but the court would not have surprised anyone by taking any of dozens upon dozens of cases in recent years on a broad range of issues that were denied cert. The bottom line is that cert grants overall are very low these days. One Law Review article recently posited that the court takes fewer cases when it's closely divided, and that would seem to make intuitive sense. That's my response. So in the end, we must keep doing what we are doing, bringing strong, carefully constructed cases against plainly unconstitutional laws and practices. And the Second Amendment Foundation remains the premier gun rights litigation organization. Of that, there should be no doubt. I will let the other lawyers who will speak with you later this afternoon address their various cases. As an aside, I'm sorry Don Kilmer couldn't make it here this year, so I'm not sure who will discuss Sylvester v. Harris, the Calgun staff case that reined in some of the excesses in California's waiting period law. I hope someone is around to discuss that one later. But I do have two cases in particular that warrant some mention, and of course I'll be available for Q&A, both at the Q&A portion later this afternoon as well as just come grab me here throughout the conference. First, after 5 years of litigation, I'm pleased to say that we won Palmer versus D.C. Just as we won Moore here in Illinois, the District of Columbia's handgun carry ban has bitten the dust. Unlike Illinois, however, the district responded with a very extreme May issue law, which district officials are not shy about admitting is designed to reinstate a regime under which no one could recall a license ever having been issued. This is not a new law requiring a new case. This is the same old practice that the court has already enjoined. In fact, our complaint, written back in 2009, addresses May issue practices, and the individual plaintiffs already had gun registrations applications denied for averring that they would carry their handguns in public for self-defense. Now, the court is not naive either. It enjoined D.C.'s unlicensed carry prohibition, quote, unless and until such time as the District of Columbia adopts a licensing mechanism consistent with constitutional standards enabling people to exercise their Second Amendment right to bear arms, close quote. And the court found that people enjoy a right to carry handguns for the same self-defense interest that they enjoy in the home. A licensing standard that doesn't treat carrying handguns as a right and which rejects self-defense as a sufficient justification for getting a license plainly fails to comply with the court's judgment. The case is not over. In the time remaining, I would also like to discuss another substantial victory that we just scored. Nobody challenges the idea that dangerous criminals, lunatics, and irresponsible people should not have guns. But the government paints with a very broad brush, often lumping together drug kingpins and serial killers, along with messy accountants and Martha Stewart. Congress knows. Congress isn't entirely clueless. They know that the federal felon in possession ban can be too broadly applied, which is why Congress created a restoration process at BATFE for deserving cases. Unfortunately, Senator Schumer, in his wisdom, has ensured that the process would be defunded for many years now. After Heller, that means that what should essentially be an administrative restoration case is thrown to the courts. 2 days ago, we won what I believe may be the first successful as-applied challenge to the federal felon in possession ban. With staff support, I represented Dan Bindrup, a peaceful, law-abiding citizen with no history of violence whatsoever, who made a very bad mistake in the mid-90s. He cheated on his wife with an employee who happened to be 17 years old. Now, in their state, Pennsylvania, the girl was old enough to consent to the relationship, and the relationship was fully consensual. That there's no question. But Bindrup was nevertheless found guilty of corruption of minors, a misdemeanor, and received a sentence of probation. Bindrup's wife forgave him. They remain happily married, over 40 years together. They've raised two great kids. He remains a successful self-employed member of his community in the state of Pennsylvania, with the prosecution's blessing, restored his gun rights under state law. The federal government we had to sue, and we won 2 days ago, because there's absolutely no reason to believe that this gentleman is a threat to anyone. Staff will continue to support cases in which harmless people are being denied their Second Amendment rights. Stay tuned. This is an area which we are developing in various ways. I have other cases for staff that are either awaiting opinions or are earlier in litigation and design phases, and I hope to share some additional positive news with you in the coming year. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Alan. Would Rosemary from American Legacy Firearms please come up? Now there'll be Q&As later on today. Is that Julian? All right. That's why we're holding them all right now. When Alan says there's more coming, he's not kidding. Now I will share. It's okay. I think I'll share with you something Alan told me just a minute ago. I said, well, we've got all these cases going, and after Heller, this like, you know, the guaranteed employment for Second Amendment attorneys, how long do you think this will go on? Said, indefinitely? He said, no. He says, not if we lose the Supreme Court. It's over. I don't know if it's over, but I don't know if I quoted you right, but basically that's the thing to be aware of, is that if we lose the Supreme Court, you have nowhere to go. So I like to throw that out for your consideration and kind of, yeah. What is it, 30-something days left on this, 38 days and counting on this election? So whatever you can do, and it's amazing sometimes how little it takes to swing an election and getting people out, emailing, talking to people, turning around to the person behind you in the checkout line at the store and saying, hey, are you going to the polls? Can I talk to you about it? I mean, I know we don't like to say I'm going to impose myself on somebody. You're not imposing. You're doing them a favor. You're helping them make an enlightened decision. But the other thing is these elections for the Senate are huge, are huge.
Can I ask a question? Once the decision is made by the Supreme Court, is it true or not to be revoked?
Oh, no. Supreme Court decisions have been basically superseded by subsequent decisions, correct? Yeah, the court can change its mind. So, yeah, it's not locked in forever. All right. I'm going to lower this down. Okay. We have Rosemary from American Legacy Firearms. Let me give you the microphone.
I'm Rosemary Solano.
Probably lower a little more.
I'm Rosemary Solano from American Legacy Firearms, And we've been doing a special project for the Second Amendment Foundation for a couple of years now. We sell custom engraved limited edition firearms. Hold up the gun. And from each sale, we donate money to the Second Amendment Foundation. We really strongly believe in the Constitution and all of our gun rights. And we are here to present a check to Alan Gottlieb. It's here's $15,000, Alan. We did come in July and actually presented another $60,000 at that time. So we're up to about $90,000 this year so far.
About $90,000 for the year so far. Thank you very, very much.
we're really happy to do it. I just want to say that we must never give up and never surrender on this subject of our gun rights. I can tell you that we will, with what we do in the next few months, we will go down in history defending our last best hope for freedom. Thank you.
On behalf of SAF, I just really want to thank Rosemary and Steve at American Legacy Firearms for what they've done for us so far and what they're continuing to do. Without their help, we probably would not be able to keep our legal action projects at the level they're at. And that's why American Legacy Firearms is one of our platinum sponsors. Thank you.
I have another announcement. I do have one other announcement. We are starting an online store called the Second Amendment Armory, and it will be selling all kinds of accessories and things, everything except the guns. And each sale will donate to the Second Amendment Foundation on that website. So we'll include some information as soon as we have the website up and running. It will be included in the mail that you get from the Second Amendment Foundation.
This is your copy. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rosemary. All right, now we come to the awards part of the lunch. Without any further ado, Alan Gottlieb.
Thank you, Tom. This is always my favorite part of GRPC because we have lots of people out here who donate lots of time, lots of talent to defend our rights and never, ever get any recognition for it. Mostly people that are in the state and local level and people that really just work tirelessly for the cause and really never get thanked. So this is our thank you to all of them, and it's really touching to me because I know how much work these people do, and without them, none of us would have our rights. So let me start by giving out the first award, and these awards are given out by both the committee and the foundation, so some of them come from different people. And for the Second Amendment Foundation Awards, I'll call Joe Tartar up to hand out those, and I'll do the ones on behalf of the committee. The first one is a committee award, and we give out every year to the Grassroots Organization of the Year. And this year was a pretty easy one for us to do. Some years it gets very, very difficult, but there was a very important law passed in a particular state that took the right to carry to the best we've ever had probably in any state, and setting a model for all of us to adopt in the other 49 states. So I would like to present this award to GeorgiaCarry.org for basically making carry legal virtually every place in the state of Georgia. Unfortunately, the people from Georgia Cary who were supposed to accept this award, not knowing, of course, they were going to get it, airplane flights got canceled, which we're going to see on a lot of our awardees. But I know that they really deserve it, and I'll get an opportunity to present to them in person, I believe. The second award goes to the Grassroots Activist of the Year. And this one is also a very difficult one to give out because the competition usually gets pretty keen. But this year, there's somebody who's really done so much beyond the call of duty and works so tirelessly with so many people that it's really a pleasure to give this one out. And again, these are all, nobody knows they're getting these, so somebody might start crying in a minute. But Frank Fiammingo from New Jersey. Yeah. Frank, please come up here. Frank, come here. The award reads, from the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep Our Arms, the 2014 Grassroots Activist of the Year, presented to Frank in recognition of his dedication to the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution and preservation of the individual right to keep and bear arms. And Frank has done so much in so many ways and touched so many people's lives, not just in New Jersey, but all across the country, actually, because he doesn't realize how far his social media really goes, I think. That he really deserves this. And I'd like to give him a chance right now as well to speak about a couple of the things that he's done and is working on and people he's helped.
Thank you so much. I don't know what to say. I really wasn't expecting this. I know it sounds like an Emmy Award thing here, but really don't know. Well, first of all, okay, the most important thing is to say that nothing happens in a vacuum. And I was fortunate enough in being able to connect with Tom Gresham and Alan Gottlieb on this very important project that we had, which was to save Shanine Allen from the persecution that she was undergoing in the state of New Jersey. Is there anyone that doesn't know the story? Okay, so we're all aware of it. This woman was being persecuted, I won't say by the prosecutor, and I won't say by the arresting officer, but I will say that she was being prosecuted by New Jersey's horrible gun laws, because at the end of the day, it is the New Jersey legislature over a period of time that is responsible for the situation that New Jersey is in today, and they're responsible for the fact that none of you with carry permits in your home states can travel safely to New Jersey and feel, and I'm not surprised that you don't want to come. I wouldn't. I mean, I have to be perfectly honest with you. I wouldn't visit New Jersey under these circumstances. You've been vetted. You know, just as Shanine was, been vetted as being a law-abiding individual, no prior criminal record, upstanding citizen. And the mistake you made was crossing the border into the state where rights go to die? That's your crime? So when we saw this, our involvement really with Shanine was one of compassion more than it was a Second Amendment rights issue. I mean, we really saw this young mother of two children, being persecuted in this way. Anyway, I just wanted to say that it would not have happened without the help of these two gentlemen. I was fortunate on being a guest on Tom's show, and he brought up the idea of putting up billboards. The billboards brought national attention. We raised money for those billboards, at which the Second Amendment Foundation was very generous in matching. And in like 2 days after having mentioned it on the Tom Gresham Gun Talk radio show, we had all the money that we needed for the billboards plus some to help pay Shanine's bills because she's been out of work for – yes. One more thing I want to say, because I don't want to throw this timing off here. It's all of you people that helped make this happen. This would never have happened if only the people of New Jersey had responded. They would have ignored us, as they have for, I don't know, 40 years. What made this happen was that people from all over the nation called the governor's office and said, we, the people of the nation of this country, do not agree with this injustice that you are implementing against Shanine. And that was what made him put, in my heart of hearts, I believe that put the pressure on him to put the pressure on the Attorney General, which wound up with in the clarification and got Shanine into the pretrial intervention. Thank you all so very much, and thank you for the award. Yes.
His XD is weeping.
This summer, I was fortunate enough to be invited to speak to Frank's group, the New Jersey Second Amendment Society. And, you know, I guess I don't get very many days off because I'm usually working weekends, traveling, speaking to groups and things, and then being back at the office during the week. So my life gets kind of harried. And there I'm speaking, they pick me up at the airport in Newark, New Jersey. And I get to speak, and they say to me, you know, gee, thank you for coming. And I go, where else would I want to spend a beautiful weekend, you know, a summer weekend, besides being in Newark, New Jersey, unarmed? And while I was there, I learned something really interesting. That New Jersey was the first state to adopt or support the Bill of Rights, but the last state to recognize it. Joe, the next award is for you to hand out.
Well, next we have a couple of awards from the Second Amendment Foundation to individuals, one of whom I will announce, but the presentation will be made later this afternoon when he speaks, and that is the Scholar of the Year Award from the Second Amendment Foundation for John Locke. John will be here later, and the actual presentation will be made then. The next one is somebody I've known a lot of years and speak with frequently and admire the work he's been doing. And he contributes to our publications and to others. And I think it's time to call up our Journalist of the Year, Dave Workman. Dave.
Oh, well, Dave. Well, that's very kind of you guys. I really appreciate this.
Now, let's turn this way so we're facing the camera.
And wait a minute, who's holding the fingers up behind me?
Right. Watch my get together.
Okay. I'm in. They've told me to make a speech, so I want the UN out. I want Eric Holder in handcuffs, and I want to thank all of you people for reading my screed over the years. This is very kind of you, and I've insulted a lot of people over the years. They had it coming. And I want you all to keep reading my stuff because, thanks to Joe here, it's the balance. It's very kind of you guys, and I will really take care of this. Be good.
Dave, you can take that away so I don't hold it.
Thank you.
The next award goes back to be given out from the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms, and this is to our Affiliate of the Year. And this is kind of embarrassing, not for the usual reasons, because the organization that's won this for the last X number of years in a row isn't going to get it this year. And it's sad because it's for their home state. Illinois State Rifle Association has gotten this award for I don't know how many years in a row, but this year they came in runner-up. The reason being is our affiliate in our home state of Washington, the Washington Arms Collectors, has gone far beyond the call of duty to fighting and supporting an initiative battles that are taking place in our state that are going to affect everybody in the gun rights movement, which I will personally talk about later. But they have raised somewhere close to $600,000 to support our efforts, aside from supplying all kinds of manpower and editorial support in their publications and at their gun shows. And so the Washington Arms Collectors gets our award this year for being in the real thick of the battle this year. And I'd like to present the award to one of their past presidents who is here today, hoping at lunch. Let's see. Raise your hand, Joe. Joe Waldron. See, we didn't serve raw meat for lunch, so he probably went somewhere else. So I'll have to hand Joe the award later. But this one goes to the Washington Arms Collectors and breaks a streak. So ISRA, you're going to have to work a little harder next year. The next award is also from the Citizens Committee, and it goes to the Gun Rights Defender of the Year. And this is also one of these awards that is really, really difficult to give out because you really have to be at the top of the heap to get it. And the competition gets keener and keener as more people in the gun rights movement have done some miraculous things for the cause. This one goes to somebody from Illinois, an attorney, David Siegel. David is involved in a lot of litigation for us, not just here in Illinois, but around the United States as well, and has probably, at this point, maybe the best win-loss record of any of our attorneys. Sorry, Alan. And he's on an amazing streak for us, and I just want to thank David. David?
Well, I appreciate this. Thank you very much. At the backbone of all of it, of course, I want to thank Second Amendment Foundation. I want to thank Alan, Julianne, Miko, all the folks there to give me the support to help further this. I got to thank Gura. Not so much for what he does, which of course. Is wonderful, great accomplishments, but some of you may or may not know that he's the one that brought me into this a bunch of years ago in the first place. So I wouldn't be, I don't know what I'd be doing, chasing ambulances, who knows, if it wasn't for Alan. So as always, I've got to express a debt of gratitude for that, and the opportunity to work with, meet and work with the wonderful attorneys and clients that I get to work with on these cases. So someone said earlier, none of this happens in a vacuum. It's certainly true. And I want to thank all of those people. And thank you.
The next award is also a Citizens Committee award that we give out. And this one will have to be, again, not presented to the person here because thanks to our air traffic control problems, they can't be here either. But this goes to it's our Gun Rights Legislator of the Year. And usually it ends up to going somebody on the federal level. But as most of you are aware this year, nothing's really been happening on the federal level. So this went to the person, in Georgia, State Representative Rick Jaspers. House Bill 60, which was that bill that basically made carry in the state of Georgia everywhere. So we'll present that to him separately because he couldn't make it either. And then we give out annually a Bill of Rights Award. And unfortunately, the person we're giving this one to cannot accept it either here today, because he's no longer with us. And we're giving this award to Aaron Zellman, who founded Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership, which has now sort of been merged under SAF direction. It'll be standing alone as a separate organization run by itself, but it's now under the SAF umbrella. So for Aaron Zellman. The award will be kept in the JFP offices. Oh, you want to accept it on its behalf? Charles Heller, who is the former executive director of JPFO.
Aaron
deserved this.
Next one is Joe.
Our next award from the foundation, again, is for somebody who couldn't get here because of whether it's a conspiracy or whatever. And believe me, I've heard about 20 different versions of conspiracies and people who might be involved with it. But it's our Second Amendment Foundation's Global Leadership Award. It goes to David Coppell, who most of you know, have read, have heard, and who would have been here today and tomorrow to perform on the agenda. But since he didn't make it, we'll get it to him. Thanks. Now, we have another award from the committee, so I'll call Alan back.
And again, thanks to the O'Hare problem of 1,900 flights being canceled and us losing a lot of attendees to speakers, our Lifetime Achievement Award, awardee is not here because he couldn't get on an airplane either. But this is an award that we're giving to Professor Joe Olson, who has been around in the gun rights movement a long time and actually started out in civil rights stuff and back in the South as a civil rights worker in the 1960s, sort of as a community organizer registering black voters. There he learned from several civil rights people and one particularly large black fellow named Bubba that nothing discouraged a bigot with a baseball bat better than a .38 revolver. Yeah. And he's founder and president of the Gun Owner Civil Rights Alliance. He's shepherded through Minnesota's shall issue carry and range protection legislation and a host of other things. And I'd like to present this to somebody who's there founding this organization with him. David Gross would come up and accept the award on his behalf.
Oh, this one is.
It's really heavy.
Yeah, it is. 32 years ago, Joe Olson and I met, and he brought me to heel and broke me to field and inspired me. And then, is it 26 years ago? He had the idea for the Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance, and he dragged me along. And then he dragged me along with him onto the NRA Board of Directors. And he's real good at seizing opportunities and guiding other people. And he never takes credit. In 2003, he and I were Citizen of the Year recipients. And he didn't make it. And I had to accept the award on his behalf. And now he's not here today for his victory lap. That's absurd. But he still continues his work. He will never quit. And we've got this new group of kids for the Gun Owner Civil Rights Alliance. We call them Gun Owner Civil Rights Alliance 2.0. And they are the best thing since sliced bread. And what Joe has continued to do is to inspire them and to guide them. And I only wish he was here to receive it himself.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you. Wait, hold on. This is spectacular. This is spectacular. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank Joe. That brings us to a number of Defender of Liberty Awards that giving out by the foundation, and I'll give this back to Joe Tartaro.
Thank you, Alan. Well, I'm going to, there's a number of these awards, and several people are here, I believe, but there are a few who are not. And we're running late on time, so I think I'm going to call out the names of awardees, and if you are here, please come up, and we'll maybe get a group picture of all of you together. But the Second Amendment Foundation Defender of Liberty Awards this year go to Bill McGrath, who at last report still hadn't gotten here, and to David Kodria. David was here. And to Charles Heller. And to Chris Bird. And to David Gross in his own right. And to Jim Wallace, Massachusetts. And Philip Van Cleve of Virginia. And Rick Patterson of Sammy, who didn't make it. And to Stephen Alstead, who of New York, who did finally make it. And to Tom Bolioli of Massachusetts.
Rick Patterson is here.
Is he?
Yeah, just got it.
Well, guys, it feels like a grenade.
Hey, how are you? Well, I'll tell you what, since you did show up, why don't you give a collective thank you at the mic?
Tom?
Alan, mine's ticking.
Thank you. Thank you very much. My name is Rick Patterson. I'm the executive director of the Sporting Arms and Ammunition Manufacturers Institute. Contrary to the earlier news, news of my demise is rather premature. I did make it, just walked in. So on behalf of everyone, thank you very, very much for this great award. It's a pleasure to be here, not just to be with such great citizens, but, well, given the disruptions, it's just a pleasure to be here. So thank you very much.
Normally, that would be... I'm going to get this down this way. Yeah. Normally, this would be the end of the presentations, and it's certainly the end of the previously known presentations, but I have one that we fomented the eastern part of the country under the Second Amendment staff, not from the Second Amendment Foundation itself, but from the whole community. And it's a new award, and it's an unusual award, and it marks a unusual and long and very important contribution to the cause. So if I have assistance from my daughter, I'd like to present the new Thomas Paine Award to Alan M. Gottlieb, founder of the Second Amendment Foundation, in recognition of his 40 years of leadership in defense of the Second Amendment, 1974 to 2014. There's a little quote here from Thomas Paine, but the main point of this presentation at the September 27, 2014 Gun Rights Policy Conference here in Chicago is that this is being made by a group that includes all of us. It's the Second Amendment Friendship Award. Now,
and on a one-time-only basis,
we're including with it a 10-volume complete set printed over 100 years ago, the writings of Thomas Paine for Allen. He gets volume one here. The other nine are on his way to his office. Allen? I'm going to stretch the time here a second. I want to say that a lot of people don't realize the leadership and the integrity and the ingenuity that Allen has brought to the whole gun rights battle. The attorneys like Gura and Siegel and others who are fighting these cases today in part can rely on a lot of the scholarship that he foresaw years ago and began with a series of 1976 and 1977 scholars and writers conferences to create the foundation for those lawsuits. And that's something we all owe Allen a lot. Thanks for it.
So, Joe, thank you, and thank all of you. I'm really very appreciative of this award, but it really should go to a lot of other people who stood behind me, my wife included, and a great staff over the years that really are extremely dedicated, and I couldn't do what I do or without them and or get the credit for what gets done. But, you know, I know Joe's been around a long time and gets teased a lot about, he's been with us since the Spanish-American War or the Civil War, you know, but Joe, I don't know how you were able to get Thomas Paine to actually sign it. Thank you.
You know, he knew Thomas Paine, and Thomas Paine was a friend of his.
Well, the late John Hosford, when he was the executive director of the committee, I believe, used to say that he went to Rome and he found some of my writings in the walls of the catacomb. And it had my byline on it. Lions 2, Christians nothing.